Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. Mexico is taking a wait-and-see approach to dealing with the Operation Lone Star buoys in the Rio Grande, at least for now. On Thursday, Mexico's top diplomat met with U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken to discuss the barrier and more. Mexico's Foreign Minister Alicia Bárcena Ibarra joined Blinken in a joint press conference to discuss stopping fentanyl and the controversial 1,000-foot anti-migrant barrier in the middle of the Rio Grande. Speaking through a translator, Bárcena said much of the barrier is on the Mexican side of the river, but because of the delicate nature of the situation, Mexico is going to wait to see how the Biden administration's lawsuit to remove the buoys plays out.
Our demand is that these buoys be removed. I hope to receive good news over the course of this month.
Last month, the Justice Department sued Texas in federal court seeking an order to remove the state's border barrier on the grounds that it violates a law that bars unauthorized construction in a navigable waterway. But Governor Greg Abbott's attorneys argue that the floating barrier is not the type of structure that violates the act because it's placed in a shallow area that ultimately does not affect navigability of the river. However, it should be noted that the state of Texas itself does operate and navigate boats in the Rio Grande near the buoys. When asked why doesn't the federal government just remove the buoys itself since it claims they're there illegally, Secretary Blinken replied that they would prefer to follow a legal process.
We're a country and a government that proceeds by rule of law.
But it was the topic of curbing the flow of fentanyl from Mexico into the United States that dominated the press conference. Nearly 110,000 Americans died last year from drug overdoses, mostly from fentanyl. Blinken told Bárcena that fighting fentanyl abuse was at the very top of the list of our priorities.
For us and for Mexico, the challenge of dealing with drugs, and particularly now synthetic drugs, is at the top of our respective agendas. Here in the United States, fentanyl, a synthetic opioid, is the number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 and 49.
Bárcena said Mexico will be digitally tracking imports, mostly from China, of the precursor ingredients used to make fentanyl in order to stop its production and then distribution.
We're losing our young people. This is a matter of public health, without a doubt. This is an issue for which there needs to be global collaboration, not just a collaboration between our countries.
Blinken said that fentanyl is no longer just a U.S. problem. The cartels have saturated the market in the United States, and they're now pushing it into other parts of the world, making it a developing global problem. The San Antonio Police Department is facing questions about how it responds to mental health calls. In June, three police officers killed Melissa Perez, a woman experiencing a mental health crisis in her apartment. The San Antonio Police Department has a mental health unit that's supposed to be called upon in these situations, but it wasn't used in this case. Instead, the officers escalated the situation, and then they were arrested for murder. TPR's Josh Peck spoke with several family members who have been impacted by the SAPD's approach to mental illness.
Luz Elena Huffman has only good things to say about the mental health unit, or MHU.
The mental health unit has been just wonderful, wonderful agency for not only my son, but for me, because it gives me peace of mind that someone is out there, that in case I need someone, they're there.
But Huffman says her 40-year-old son's experiences with regular SAPD officers have been awful. Her son, who experiences hallucinations and delusions, made a concerning call to the FBI in March that got forwarded to SAPD. Huffman says he was home alone when officers broke in and violently removed him.
They literally put him to the ground, hit him, and dragged him out to the front of the house.
Officers told her he was under arrest for assaulting a police officer when she arrived. Charges were dismissed a week later after MHU officers came to the home and took statements from Huffman and her son. She's now fearful of calling SAPD for help because of the March incident and Perez's killing.
If I see that he's in danger or that his delusions are really, really extremely horrible, then I would not have a choice. But if I see that delusions are not that extreme and I can handle, then I will not.
Perez's family did not have that choice. SAPD officers responded to her apartment complex after they were told by the fire department that they found her cutting fire alarm wires. Perez, who had schizophrenia, told firefighters and officers that she believed the FBI was using the fire alarms to spy on her. Perez fled from officers into her apartment after being questioned. When they attempted to get into her locked apartment, she threw a candlestick and brandished a hammer. Officers then shot and killed her.
The officers need more training. They need an ongoing training because they need to understand and they need to learn how to handle situations.
Columba Wilson says she called SAPD's non-emergency number in March when her grandson Christian scratched her badly enough to make her bleed. He was asleep in bed when officers arrived, but Wilson says they insisted that he needed to be taken to jail. The 75-year-old told them no and tried to block the door.
Another police grabbed my left arm and twisted. They twisted so hard. And they had me handcuffed and they threw me against the wall.
Her grandson was put in cuffs and taken away. She says someone from the district attorney's office got in contact with her shortly after the arrest and got Christian sent back home without charges. Wilson says her grandson didn't speak or eat for days after the incident. She says an internal affairs officer blamed her for what happened to Christian.
And the answer was, well, we didn't call you, you called us.
SAPD said in a statement that Wilson's description of her interaction with internal affairs was, quote, not an accurate representation. Wilson says Perez's killing solidified her position on the police.
My grandson would have been aggressive. I'm afraid they would have shot him. Yes, I am afraid, and I would never call the police again.
An SAPD statement said officers must make an arrest for any family violence incident, and that officers were found to have acted appropriately following an investigation into the incident. The department did not make Police Chief William McManus available for an interview. Parents TPR spoke with were unanimous that the MHU's officers were valuable resources. They were also unanimous that they weren't available often enough. In 2022, the MHU responded to 5,200 calls. There were over 32,000 total mental health-related calls to SAPD in the same year. Doug Beach is the executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in San Antonio.
I think we need to look at what best practices are in other cities, what's working, and it feels like we're totally under-resourced, and we need to take a fresh look.
He says San Antonio should look to Denver, Colorado, which has a Support Team Assisted Response Program, or STAR program. Evan Tompkins is the STAR program specialist. Unlike San Antonio's MHU, STAR exists entirely separate from Denver law enforcement. But Tompkins says it started with the co-responders program in 2016.
Mental health clinicians respond with the police to specific calls. You know, while that program is great during that time, 2016, 2017, there kind of started to be this recognition that some of these lower level calls didn't really need a police officer there.
Community activists and Denver City officials reviewed an alternate response program in Oregon in 2019 and launched a 6-month pilot in Denver in 2020 that expanded into the STAR program. Tompkins says STAR has responded to 12,000 calls since it launched and has never called for police backup. STAR also provides services like transport to shelters or medical treatment centers, which Tompkins says law enforcement probably wouldn't do.
We have 8 vans in service, so it's 16 teams. So each team is made up of 1 behavioral health clinician and then 1 EMT or paramedic.
That's 32 on-the-ground staff members in Denver, a city of roughly 700,000. And Tompkins says they plan to expand. The MHU in San Antonio has 20 total staff. A few more staff work with the San Antonio Community Outreach and Resiliency Effort, or CORE team, which responds to mental health calls for a small subsection of the city. The team serves San Antonio, a city of nearly 1.5 million, over twice Denver's size. Tompkins says STAR costs roughly $5.5 million per year. The money comes from the city's general fund and a sales tax initiative approved by Denver voters in 2020. San Antonio's public safety budget, which includes police and fire, topped $900 million in fiscal year 2023. Doug Beach, the San Antonio mental health advocate, says the city's current policy is failing and big change is needed.
We're stretched across the board. Every community is. But that's no excuse for operating the way we do. And I think that incrementalism, you know, adding one unit here, two officers there, that's not an answer.
As city and police officials consider new ways to handle San Antonio's mental health crisis, families like Huffman's and Wilson's will continue to struggle with their loved ones and wonder who to turn to when they need help. I'm Josh Peck in San Antonio.
The investigation into the murder of Melissa Perez at the hands of San Antonio police officers continues as the city waits to see if any of the arrested officers are going to be indicted for the crime. But questions remain about how the city's police force polices itself. TPR first reported on a troublesome disciplinary history involving two of the officers. Now accountability reporter Paul Flab raises more concerns about how it manages officers.
The same year that patrolman Elazar Alejandro was suspended three times, twice for neglect of duty, incompetence, and violation of rules, his annual evaluation made no reference to the disciplinary infractions, nor to the combined 40 days of suspension without pay.
If you're suspended from as a result of an internal affairs investigation, that's something that is significant that ought to be reflected in the evaluation.
Jonathan Smith, a former Justice Department official who investigated police departments' civil rights violations for more than 4 years. Instead, the evaluation said Alejandro met expectations in things like competency, interpersonal skills, professionalism, and judgment. In fact, that box was checked for the entire document. Former Arlington Police Chief Theron Brown says that's odd.
I would expect to at least see a note or an entry in the performance evaluation stating that Officer Alejandro had difficulty with issues of conduct and behavior.
The San Antonio Police Department did not give TPR an interview on this story, instead releasing a statement saying disciplinary actions are about specific incidents and yearly evaluations are about supervisors assessing overall performance. They're conducted by different parts of the department and serve different purposes. According to SAPD's policy, they look past the specific, quote, isolated incidents and at the totality of an officer's performance. But Brown says most officers go their entire 25 to 30-year careers without three suspensions of 15 days or more.
And to see three major suspensions recommended within about a four-month period is really unusual. It's a really serious reflection of the officer's alleged misconduct.
For Detective Alfred Flores, the same year, disciplinary records say he skipped an active shooting to grab lunch and then failed to turn in a bag of money and drugs. He not only met expectations on his evaluation, he was promoted to sergeant. Again, Jonathan Smith.
It suggests it's no big deal. And that is a really bad message to send to officers in the department. It's a bad message to officers who engage in misconduct, and it's a bad message to officers who want to work in a department where there's order and discipline and they know that what's expected of them.
According to SAPD policy, annual evaluations aren't used in promotions. That fact raises questions about the usefulness of the documents at all. They aren't used in promotions or note discipline. The documents list scant information, lack any narrative of discussion or space for it, and are a series of boxes to check around training, discussion, and career development.
These evaluations are not taken as seriously as they should be.
In addition to the lack of specificity, they aren't thorough. Regarding Flores, one appears to be either misdated or was conducted a year late, redundantly.
Employees/personnel need to understand what opportunities they have to improve, to provide higher value to the organization.
Jonathan Smith says you're doing no one any favors by not identifying areas of concern and ways to address them. And that's what's reflected here.
You know, you're risking harm to the community. You're risking, you know, risk to the credibility of the department. And candidly, you're risking that officer's career by not correcting their ongoing behavior.
SAPD does use an early warning system to flag potential problem officers, but the department has tried to block TPR from obtaining open records that may show its effectiveness at preventing future disciplinary action. In the end, for Bowman, who was police for 30-plus years, if these officers meet expectations, it could suggest SAPD expects officers to behave this way. After all, the evaluations are reviewed by multiple ranks and commands.
So that it's ironic, but it may be a reflection of the truth. It may be a reflection of a reality. And if that's the case, and I'm a resident of San Antonio, then I think I'm a little bit concerned.
SAPD declined to answer the question about whether multiple infractions and suspensions indeed meet their expectations. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Being evicted is a legal process. There are rules that govern this in the Texas Property Code. But what happens when landlords use strong-arm tactics outside the law to push tenants out? KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
Nicole Hernandez says her landlord subjected her to months of harassment, trespassing, and property destruction before taking her to eviction court.
They've cut the valves on my tires. They've broke AC unit in the middle of the heat and stole my fan out of my room, kicked in a deadbolt lock on my door. Yeah, so it's gotten pretty crazy.
Hernandez's landlord was also her employer, but in January, their relationship went south. The landlord demanded she move out. Hernandez said she'd go when the landlord followed the law to properly evict her. 6 months later, the landlord took her to court. Hernandez lost, and she had about a week to move out or appeal. But later that day, she says she returned home to find her air conditioner destroyed. It was over 100 degrees that week.
The heat was making me very sick, and I felt like it was hard for me to breathe, just walk from my bed into the bathroom, drenching my hair and all that, and sitting in wet clothes.
The landlord did not respond to multiple requests for comment.
We've had a lot of cases where landlords have pulled breakers to turn the power off, or literally turn the power off with the power company, or damaged AC units.
Mark Melton from the Dallas Eviction Advocacy Center says he's seen landlords aggressively tow cars or drag their feet on repairs. He's seen more extreme cases, like a client with young kids whose landlord paid local gang members to intimidate her. These are not the majority of cases, but Melton says they're also not infrequent.
They want to make it as miserable as possible for that tenant to stay so that they'll leave voluntarily so that they don't have to go through the trouble of filing an eviction and waiting the time to get them out.
Jason Simon from the Apartment Association of Greater Dallas says most landlords are committed to providing safe and habitable apartments and following the law, but there are always bad actors.
I would condemn anyone for putting someone's life at risk over an air conditioner or retaliating or destroying someone's home.
Other tactics to push tenants out are less clear-cut, says Dewey Marshall from the Texas Tenants Union. He often hears from people whose landlords declined to renew their lease after they complained about problems in their rental unit, like one woman who called him recently.
This person saw an increase in their water bill, contacted their landlord to ask about why there is an increase in the water bill because it looked like it was more than what one person uses. And then had the water shut off 2 weeks later and also got a notice of non-renewal for their lease.
Marshall says this sounds like illegal retaliation, but proving that is hard. Either way, he says this kind of displacement can be nearly as traumatic as a formal eviction. Research shows people who've been evicted often face homelessness, earn less money, have poorer health, and their kids do worse in school. And eviction cases are up across Texas. Melton, the eviction lawyer, points out those numbers don't include the tenants who are forced out outside of eviction courts.
I'm not trying to say that these stories that I'm telling are true across the board in every apartment complex in Dallas, because they're not. But there is a significant portion, primarily around people that are poor, where they are just being abused day in and day out with no recourse.
Melton says Texas should do more to protect tenants, but in the meantime, he thinks courts need to do a better job of making sure tenants' existing rights are enforced. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Texas prisons have seen nearly two people die each day this summer. A persistent, record-setting, deadly heat wave has sat on top of the state for at least 2 months. State prisons have seen a spike in deaths across the board. But Texas officials have yet to confirm a heat-related prison death so far this year, and in fact, it has been more than a decade since the last one. That's despite the state not having air conditioning in 2/3 of its prisons. Studies have challenged the death findings. Texas Public Radio's accountability reporter Paul Flav reports.
Julie Scarra doesn't buy that Texas hasn't seen a heat-related death in 12 years.
The idea that there have been no heat-related deaths since 2012 is just false.
Scarra wrote her PhD dissertation on the topic and published her findings last November in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Open Network. Her study attributed 271 deaths between 2001 and 2019, likely to unair-conditioned Texas facilities and heat. That's 30 times the national average. She says just because it wasn't a heat stroke doesn't mean it wasn't heat related.
But heat exhaustion can be pretty mild and heat strokes are pretty rare. And there's a lot of things that can happen in between that are related to heat and also cause death.
The Texas Department of Criminal Justice disputed the study's findings, saying it didn't consider age and listed cause of death, as well as which units had some housing areas cooled. Scarra's work was peer-reviewed, though. And TPR confirmed it used standard methods with the data. Data from the state shows that heat in Texas prisons is regularly over what's considered safe in county jails at 85 degrees and increasingly sweltering over 90 and 95 for many hours a day. Even for young, healthy adults, at 95 degrees, when it's humid, that's dangerous.
Do you mind if I put this closer to him?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Many in Texas prisons like Joseph Garza aren't in great health and aren't young.
You know, me personally, I'm 47. I have a hard time breathing. My chest, I wake up numb sometimes. You know, I put in for medical over times about this. Just trying to keep out of people's way. You lay there and sweat.
Garza lives in the Dominguez State Jail outside San Antonio. It does not have air-conditioned housing areas, and about 60 men live in his dormitory-style section. He says he's lucky. His bed's near the mounted industrial fan, and the unit has ongoing access to showers.
Just jumping in showers like 20 times, like, you know, trying to stay in there.
But he says it's still too hot. Many walk around with heat rashes and other ailments. Last month, state data shows there were only 2 days where the internal temperature measured under 90 degrees.
It's really hot in there, man. It's almost, I really feel, to be honest, like we're jerky. We're slowly being cooked, you know, and it's frustrating.
Larry Kenny is a physiology professor at Penn State University and studies the limits of human tolerance to heat.
We've known for decades and decades that as we come older, we become less tolerant to the heat.
When we're hot and sweating isn't cooling us down, our core temperature can rise and our hearts pump harder to cool the skin. That puts a lot of strain on the organ. During heat waves, this is the most likely reason people go to the ER, he says.
Cardiovascular strain as part of this unrelenting heat is a major issue.
32 people have suffered cardiac arrest or heart attacks in Texas prisons, according to state data, with many more being found unresponsive without explanation. But TDCJ says that number's been relatively stable from 2021 on. Texas prisons do have a significant spike in deaths system-wide, though. A 5.5-year analysis of custodial death reports conducted by TPR shows an additional 2 people per 10,000 dying in Texas prisons this summer, compared to 2018 and 2019. That's significant, says David Pyruz, a criminology professor at the University of Colorado Boulder who studies prisons.
It seems pretty abundantly clear to me that the mortality rates, at least in the summer of 2023, are comparable to what we see in 2021 and 2022, if not worse, but especially it deviates strongly from what we would think of as business as usual.
He says the data from TPR looks like some of the bad months during the pandemic, but not because of COVID.
So, you know, those numbers are much higher. So there is something taking place here. And whether it's heat, whether it's personnel, whether it's access to medical resources, these are important things to find out.
But is there a direct connection between the Texas heat and the death spike that TPR's found this summer?
It's tricky, yeah.
Julie Scarra says there just isn't enough data in custodial death reports to know. But either way, Scarra's work has convinced her that the way Texas houses prisoners is untenable.
I think air conditioning is a requirement. It is essential for human health in these settings. Like a 30-fold increase in heat-related mortality is absolutely ridiculous.
As climate change increases the likelihood of extreme heat, she says the situation becomes even more dire for Texas prisoners. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Three former inmates of Smith County, east of Dallas, recently filed a lawsuit against the county. They claim that they were held behind bars for weeks past the end of their sentences. The attorney bringing the lawsuit says overdetention is a problem throughout Texas. And as KERA's Brett Jaspers reports, more Smith County inmates are speaking up.
As the East Texas hay season stretched into July, Lisa Stone and her husband needed the help of their son, Jason, on the family farm. Jason was finishing a sentence in the Smith County jail.
I had just fallen and hurt my knee, and I could just barely walk. And I was thinking, well, Jason will be home and he can help me. And then he didn't get to come home, and that upset me pretty bad.
Both Lisa and Jason had been trying to nail down his release date. According to their calculations, that should have been July 1st, a day that came and went. Lisa called Texas state agencies, as well as Smith County offices. She found the lack of information frustrating.
You're not offering to try to find out any of this information. You're just sitting there holding them. And if somebody don't say anything, who knows how long they would stay in there.
Luckily, Jason was released on July 7th. His story echoes that of three other Smith County inmates who filed a lawsuit against the county last month. Attorney Nathan Fennell with the Texas Fair Defense Project said overdetention is a problem across the state.
We've heard from people in counties that range from very, very small to very, very large.
KERA recently reported on a case of overdetention in Dallas County. There, courts have struggled with a new case management system, and other staff lost access to a separate tech platform managed by the sheriff. But it's hard to know exactly what the holdup is in some of these county jails.
Jails are notoriously opaque spaces.
The Smith County Sheriff's Office declined an interview and said it doesn't comment on pending litigation. County Sheriff Larry Smith, in a presentation earlier this year, said the county's incarceration rate in May 2022 was about twice that of the state. He also expressed concerns about staffing and the prospect of renting space in other counties.
Anytime before this pandemic and everything, you could go to just about any sheriff and they would hold your inmates for them. They have no room anymore.
But the narrative around overcrowding is complicated by examples of jails keeping inmates past the end of their sentences. So, what about oversight? A county jail can be deemed non-compliant with state standards if it releases an inmate early without proper authorization. But there's no corresponding punishment for releasing an inmate late. Brandon Wood runs the Texas Commission on Jail Standards. He said his agency's inspections don't include overdetention.
Whenever we do inspections, we will look to ensure that, you know, they have the proper release documents. We are not sitting there actually calculating good time credit or sentence time that they've actually done.
Advocates would like regulators to do more. Krish Gundu is co-founder of the Texas Jail Project.
It's hypocrisy to have really strong oversight when people are being released before their time, for whatever reason. But there is nothing in place to ensure that people are released in a timely manner.
Adoption of a new rule needs approval from the jail commissioners themselves, a body appointed by the Texas governor. The state legislature could also pass a law. Barring that, Jason Stone said having his mom on the outside advocating for him made all the difference.
If I wouldn't have my mom out here pulling for me and calling and doing whatever she could do, Lord knows I may still be sitting in there.
And not everyone has a champion on the outside making those calls. I'm Brett Jaspers.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can download, subscribe, and rate us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.